Honoured guests, fellow students, welcome. Welcome to this, the inaugural meeting of the LSE Students' Union Global Festival. My name is Martin Lewis, I'm the General Secretary of the Students' Union, and I shall be chairing the meeting. Some years ago, this union became the first in Britain to pass a joint motion between the Friends of Palestine Society and the Jewish Society asking for peace in the Middle East. It's beyond the wildest dreams of those of us behind that motion that just a few short years later, His Excellency Moshe Raviv, the Israeli ambassador, and Mr. Afif Safir, head of the PLO delegation to the United Kingdom, should be here in the same old theatre that motion was debated, together endorsing our global festival towards global peace. Our programme for today will involve speeches from both sides, followed by a question session. I do hope you all enjoy yourselves, participate, and celebrate the festival with us. With that, I move to Vinnie Gattati, Equal Opportunities and Welfare Officer, to introduce the festival as a whole.
Welcome to the LSE Students' Union's Global Festival to mark the centenary of the LSE. The LSE has students from well over 100 countries. This number exceeds the amount of nations who are members of the World Bank. Hence, the Global Festival is an event which reflects the diversity of our student body. The main aims of the festival are to promote cultural awareness, unity in diversity, understanding, equality, and to promote peace. As you may have seen in our posters and leaflets, we have a wide range of cultural shows and ethnic food throughout the week. We have strived to keep this festival free of charge for all students to encourage them to attend. I would like to thank the various embassies and high commissions who have shown tremendous enthusiasm and support for our ideas and aims. Also, special thanks to the Global Festival Committee, Joe Dufort, Mia Gilia, Sylvia Santoro, Umar Sumro, Ben Oliver, and Nick Fletcher, and all the society presidents for getting this festival off the ground. And not to forget the tremendous support and advice we've received from Louis Ashfield and Peter Howells at the LSE conference office and the school community as a whole. In respect of those who have died in striving to further world peace, I ask that we now observe a minute's silence. Thank you, and enjoy the festival.
Thank you, Vinny. I'd now like to introduce Muna Weber, Chair of the LSE Friends of Palestine Society, to introduce His Excellency, Mr. Moshe Raviv.
Thank you, Martin. Peace between the Friends of Palestine and the Jewish Society here at the London School of Economics came in 1991 when a joint motion was put forward by both our societies at this very podium at a Union General meeting. Standing here today, I assure you that neither society could have foreseen that we would all be meeting here 4 years later at such a momentous occasion. His Excellency Mr. Moshe Raviv has been Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom since 1993. Born in Romania in 1935, he moved to Israel in 1948. He studied at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and graduated in international relations at University College London. He joined the Ministry of Foreign Affairs while continuing his studies, and from 1966 till 1968 became political secretary to the Foreign Minister Abba Eban. For the four following years, he was political counselor at the Embassy of Israel in Washington, D.C. Between the years of 1974 and 1983, he held a number of posts at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was director of the East European Division, director of the North American Division, and then director of the Economic Division. He was also ambassador to the Philippines for 3 years. From 1983 till 1988, he was minister plenipotentiary at the Embassy of Israel in London. And from 1988 till 1993, deputy director general in charge of information at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom, His Excellency Mr. Moshe Raviv.
Mr. Chairman, Muna, Mr. Safia, Dr. Liefer, members of the panel, students. It gives me a great pleasure to open the London School of Economics Global Week in conjunction with Mr. Afif Safia, with students from many countries gathered here to study in London. The London School of Economics is one of the most international institutions in the world. Moreover, as an Israeli, I commend the initiative to organize an event enabling foreign students not only to promote their own country, their own culture, their own education, but at the same time to promote global peace. And God knows how much we all need global peace. I always welcome the opportunity to discuss the peace process in the Middle East in the presence of Mr. Afif Safia. On some issues, we agree. On others, we differ. But this very fact in itself demonstrates the distance that we have traveled since September 1993 and the Oslo Agreement. The peace process, ladies and gentlemen, is moving forward. True, we are still in the initial stages. We need to consolidate the agreements that have been reached. But the trend is irreversible. The mood changes from optimism to gloom and vice versa as often as the London weather. And now we are all in a particularly difficult stage. Therefore, let us refrain from daily measurements of the temperature or the density of the clouds. Let us base our judgments on periodic reviewing because this is more instructive and more accurate. In the past 16 months, we have registered remarkable progress. One could say we have achieved historic breakthroughs in the peace process. The Israeli Defense Forces have withdrawn from Gaza and Jericho. For the first time in their history, Palestinians are now responsible for running their own lives. The Palestinian administration is responsible for close to 1 million people and their daily affairs. On December 1st, 1994, we have completed the transfer of responsibility for five key areas on the West Bank to the Palestinian administration. This is beyond Gaza and Jericho. And these are very important areas. They are education, health services, welfare, tourism, and direct taxation. Considerable amounts of international funding is flowing to the Palestinian administration for economic development in the territories. In Israel, we have established the first diplomatic links with Arab countries, with Muslim countries, beyond our close proximity, with Morocco, with Tunis. Israeli diplomatic delegations visited Qatar, Oman, and Bahrain. At the Casablanca conference, an extensive exchange of views between Israeli and Arab businessmen from the public sector and the private sector took place, and the Arab boycott is eroding. All this happened in the past 16 months since the Oslo Agreement was signed. However, during the same period, we also suffered 123 Israelis who were killed by Hamas and jihad terror. The ultimate price is paid by their families. But every day of grief is causing a tremendous anxiety and tremendous anguish and has a political price and is a setback to the peace process. Terror has encouraged the opponents to the Oslo Agreement on our side, and it has encouraged the enemies of peace on the other side. And you may ask why I make this distinction between opponents of peace and enemies of peace. Because on our case, the opponents of peace are working within a democratic framework. And the enemies of peace are using the gun, the suicide bomber, the Molotov cocktail, and every explosive that they can lay their hand on. And so they are trying to undermine the tremendous efforts made by the Israeli government and the Palestinian leadership, efforts which are backed by the majority of the populations on both sides. It is because of this that the peace process is slower than we have anticipated. It is clear to us that the vast majority of Palestinians and the territories are supportive of the pragmatic wing led by Chairman Arafat. They can sense the value of their achievements and the promise in the continuation of the peace process. In a recent poll taken by a Palestinian organization, the Center for Palestinian Research, the following statistics have emerged. 42% supported Fatah and only 17.4% supported Hamas. Alas, up to now, this vast majority did not come out to actively defend their achievements and to make sure that the continuation of the peace process in a good and proper environment is assured. There is a convergence of interest between Israel and the PLO to move forward, not to stand still, not to allow the enemies of peace to gain ground. However, the horrendous acts of terror, like the suicide bombing of a bus on the streets of Tel Aviv, the brutal killing of 21 soldiers on January 22nd, have filled the country with a great deal of doubt and a great deal of anguish. And people are asking many questions that before this terror did not surface. People look back at the commitments in Oslo and are looking back at the letter that Chairman Arafat has written to Prime Minister Rabin on September 9, 1993, which is an integral part of the Oslo Agreement. And so he wrote, I quote, "The PLO considers that the signing of the Declaration of Principles constitutes a historic event inaugurating a new epoch of peaceful coexistence, free from violence which endangers peace and stability." And people justifiably are asking, is this brutal and indiscriminate killing consistent with that commitment? Is this killing conducive to an atmosphere of fruitful negotiations? And most importantly, what message is Arafat sending to the Palestinians when he does not outrightly condemn these despicable acts? The chairman of the PLO has at his disposal now an administration. He has an armed police, trained police force. He knows all the addresses of the terrorist leaders. In what way and how effectively is he acting in order to stop the outrage? Renunciation of terror by Arafat in his letter of September 9, 19, to the Prime Minister Rabin was a cornerstone of the Oslo Agreement. We feel that the Palestinian administration is not doing enough, and not doing enough in a robust and proper manner. I'm not saying that when they try, and they did try, they did not register some success in preventing terror. But this is not enough. And Gaza is becoming, unfortunately, a haven for killers and for terrorists. I can echo only the words of the new American ambassador to Israel and his testimony before Congress. He said, as an American, "We do not expect of Chairman Arafat 100% of success, but we do expect 100% of effort, and so do we." Instead of creating an atmosphere conducive to building confidence and trust, the continuation of terror builds up animosity and mistrust. We are aware of the difficulties. We are not interested in a Palestinian civil war. For decades, the PLO and their chairman maintained that they are the sole representatives of the Palestinian people. Now, they command the power, they command the force, they are responsible for the lives of a million people, and with a prospect of extending this administration to more than another million people. Because we are just at the first step. The Gaza-Jericho Agreement is meant to be the first phase, and we would like to move on to the next phases. Let them assert themselves. Let them grasp the challenge and make the best of a very rare opportunity. The four-way summit, which ended in Cairo a few days ago on February the 2nd, was a welcome development. For the first time, we see the Israeli Prime Minister and Foreign Minister meeting in conference with three out of five of our partners in the peace process in an Arab capital in Cairo. This is the type of dialogue that is very common practice in the European Union, in the Americas, but it is a novelty in the Middle East. The very dialogue is important. The more immediate purpose was to relaunch the peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. 2 points in the Cairo joint communique are especially worth noting. Firstly, the determination of all the four leaders to continue the Middle East peace process, aiming at a comprehensive peace. Secondly, the strong condemnation of all outrages of bloodshed, of terror and violence, and they committed themselves to put an end to such acts. However, this did not prevent Hamas from killing another Israeli this morning, as to say to Mr. Arafat, "You can sign whatever you wish, you can go to Cairo and you go to Damascus, but we shall continue with our killings." The Israeli government is clearly committed to the continuation of the peace process. However, we cannot ignore the lessons of the implementation of Gaza and Jericho. The importance, on the other hand, of the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan can hardly be overstated. It is clearly beneficial to both countries and to the region as a whole. Yesterday evening, Crown Prince Hassan of Jordan had for dinner in Amman 35 members of Knesset, of the Israeli parliament, of all parties. They were discussing the peace agreement between our two countries and how this agreement could practically be applied in day-to-day life. And I can only echo what the prince said, which I believe was mainly directed to some people, to some skeptics in Jordan. And he said, I quote, "We must stop apologizing for the peace agreement and start building it." And we find ourselves in complete agreement with His Royal Highness. Today, we are also meeting in Cairo with a Palestinian negotiating delegation in order to negotiate the modalities for elections in Gaza and on the West Bank. According to the Oslo Agreement, elections are connected with the redeployment of the Israeli Defense Forces from the West Bank towns. But in view of our bitter experience with terror, we cannot allow other safe havens for extremists, for fundamentalist terrorists on the West Bank cities and expose the lives of thousands of Israelis to immediate and imminent danger. So together with the Palestinians, we have to find a way which will allow for the elections to take place as soon as possible. But at the same time, the elections will also take into account the Israeli acute security concerns. In the next 10 days, there will be other two encounters between us and the Palestinians around the negotiating table. In Washington, our foreign minister with the same representatives that met in Cairo, the foreign minister of Egypt and Jordan and the representative of the PLO, will be meeting again to try and speed up negotiations. And on Thursday, Prime Minister Rabin will meet with Chairman Arafat at the Erez crossing. So on our part, we shall continue to do whatever we can to speed up negotiations, to widen the autonomy, and to bring the negotiations to the next important stage, which will be the negotiations on the permanent status. Our aim remains a comprehensive peace with our neighbors, with all our neighbors, including Syria and including Lebanon. And we hope that on these two fronts, negotiations too will make progress. Yet, our efforts must be matched by our partners. We cannot make peace alone. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, for a very intriguing and most revealing speech. I'd now like to call upon Naomi Hill, Chair of the LSE Jewish Society, to introduce Mr. Afish Safir, Head of the PLO Delegation to the United Kingdom.
Thank you, Martin, and thank you, Your Excellency, for such an informative and positive account of your vision of the situation in the Middle East. Although there have been many tragedies during the peace process, there is now no turning back. Palestinians and Israelis must grasp this opportunity that has now been offered. We must go forward and face the future together. In 1994, our two societies again joined up to put forward an anti-racism motion at another Union General Meeting. We came together in friendship and in hope, and now, 1 year later, we are proud to see that Jews and Palestinians all over the world are still working towards peace. Our second special guest speaker this evening is Mr. Afif Safia, who has been the Palestinian General Delegate to the United Kingdom since September 1990. He was born in Jerusalem in 1950 and studied at Le Frere College. He graduated in political science and international relations at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium. While studying there, he was president of the Belgian section of the General Union of Palestinian Students for 2 years until 1971, followed by a year's presidency of the French branch. Between 1976 and 1978, he was deputy director of the Palestine Liberation Organization Observer Mission to the United Nations in Geneva. And for 3 years after that, he was staff member in Yasser Arafat's office in Beirut, in charge of European affairs and United Nations institutions. Acting as a special envoy of Mr. Arafat in 1980, he was received in a private audience by Pope John Paul II. He returned to the Catholic University of Louvain as a researcher at the Centre for European Studies and has also been a visiting scholar at the Centre for International Affairs in Harvard University. From 1987 until 1990, he was the PLO representative to the Netherlands and was also involved in the 1988 Stockholm negotiations that led to the official and direct American-Palestinian dialogue. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the Palestinian General Delegate to the United Kingdom, Mr. Afif Safia.
Thank you very much, Naomi. Mr. Chairman, my friend Dr. Nabil Shaath today has an interview published by Robert Fisk in The Independent, where he very eloquently states the Palestinian perspective on the current peace talks. So I thought that you deserved better than me replaying the same tune and the same melody. So I decided to speak of something else, which could be titled, Those Were the Days. Ambassador Raviv, ladies and gentlemen, of the many duties I have had to undertake here in London during the last 4 years, your invitation today will probably be the one I will remember in the future with the greatest tenderness and affection. Having been successively, some two decades ago, president of both the Belgian, then the French sections of the General Union of Palestinian Students, your invitation has plunged me in nostalgic recollections of what is supposed to have been the golden age of the international student movement, from Berkeley to Belgium and Berlin, from Paris to Prague. Those were the days, my friends, when we reinvented the world and the future almost every day. Voracious readers, we used to engage in sleepless nights and endless talk about the ideal society. Some of us were ready to die in bringing about their ideals. Others wanted simply to live them. Schools of thought proliferated, and they all revolved around the idea of social change, and yes, already then, a new international system. Some thought change in the center would be the decisive factor, while others considered changes in the periphery to be the recommended course of action. Some regarded the working classes in the industrialized nations to be the major agents of change, while others looked upon the peasantry of the third world as the vehicle for social transformation. Some argued that the state, which had to become a neutral body based on meritocracy, will assume this function by being the guarantor, the regulator, and the redistributor within society, while others were extremely flattered by Herbert Marcuse, one of my generation's favorite authors, who used to flatter our egos with his theory that in our contemporary society, where we witness the embourgeoisement of the proletariat and the continuing conservatism of the peasantry, students and only the students were the sole agents of the desirable change. Students, those future intellectuals, was a topic that Antonio Gramsci had addressed with great eloquence, advocating a special relationship between the oppressed and the intelligentsia. He called for an alliance between those who think because they suffer and those who suffer because they think. So we thought, and I'm sure that our elders must have suffered when hearing us think aloud, but that's altogether another story. Our slogans then reflected l'air du temps. d'imagination au pouvoir was one of those. Le droit à la différence, the right to be different. Il est interdit d'interdire, it's forbidden to forbid. A favorite among many was le droit à la paresse, the right to be lazy, which incidentally, Mr. Chairman, referred to the legitimacy and desirability of general strikes rather than the appealing notion of dolce vita based on far niente. Il faut s'occuper de la politique, sinon la politique s'occupera de vous. You should take care of politics, or else politics will take care of you. And the last that I will quote, politics is too important to be left to politicians. Ladies and gentlemen, each of us had his or her heroes and maîtres à penser. Some became dogmatic and doctrinaire. But great intellectual diversity and tolerance was the major feature of those times. I was what we then used to call eclectic, belonging to no chapel, to no clique, to no clan. Because of my historical and sociological background, Jesus and Muhammad had undeniable influence on my intellectual upbringing. The principles of liberté, fraternité, égalité, and the French Revolution itself had exercised a great fascination on me. As a Palestinian who favored Arab unity, I showed an early interest in Bismarck, Cavour, and Garibaldi, but also in Jean Monnet. I read Marx in depth, but never became a Marxist myself, yet had often to protect him from frequent misinterpretation, distortions, and mutilations of some of his disciples, just as many of us have frequently to proclaim God's innocence of beliefs and behaviors perpetrated on his or her behalf. Let us not forget that Jewish fundamentalists have transformed God into some sort of real estate agent. I devoted much time to Lenin and Mao, finishing an MA thesis in the very Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, in fact, the oldest Catholic university in the world, established in 1425, slightly older than the London School of Economics, on revolutionary strategies and the conquest of power, a comparative study of the Bolshevik and Maoist revolutions. Yet I had a special weakness towards those who encountered a tragic fate, Che Guevara, JFK, and Martin Luther King, or were maltreated by history and by their contemporaries, Leon Trotsky, or had conquered power only to abandon it voluntarily, Emiliano Zapata. To add to the irritation of some of my friends, I remained totally unseduced and unmoved by the Chinese Cultural Revolution and openly preferred Chu Enlai, the state builder, the technocrat, to the unattractive and constantly intriguing manipulative agitator, Lin Piao. Ladies and gentlemen, the list would be incomplete if I were to omit my obsession and my observation of De Gaulle, this Western leader that Stanley Hoffman had called an artiste de la politique. He had had to struggle brilliantly against foes and friends alike to maintain the rank of France undiminished after its devastating defeat in 1940. The analogy with the Palestinian re-emerging national movement would not have escaped you. His tumultuous relationship with that other giant, Winston Churchill, would keep me awake night after night. Churchill had summarized this complex rapport by saying, "Of the many crosses I have had to carry, the cross of Lorraine was surely the heaviest." The cross of Lorraine being, of course, the symbol of the French Resistance. Again, regional analogies were obvious. My fascination with De Gaulle, ladies and gentlemen, was responsible for some of my most tormenting moments. I was then in total solidarity with the French student movement, but this movement was irreparably destabilizing De Gaulle. Anyway, even his abdication was done with such grandeur that his place in history, undiminished and unstained, was preserved for posterity. In 1972, I moved from Belgium to the Institut d'Études Politiques in Paris and got involved in discussions on the nature and the scope of political science itself. Some of you present here today would remember that as a relatively new discipline, political science was still struggling to assert itself and its domain. Some still called it then political sciences in the plural, seeing in it as a sort of interdisciplinary field. It is true dealing with the study of the state of government and of power in general, but encompassing pell-mell history, international relations, sociology, and economics with very unclear demarcation lines. In the Anglo-Saxon countries, They had no problem describing students of and experts in political science. They were called political scientists. But in the French-speaking world, even that subject was a subject for debate and dissent. Some called him or her politiste. Others preferred politologue, and others favored politicologue. The jokers would simply say, les sciences poseurs. Ladies and gentlemen, this was the flavor of those times. We were then young and audacious, questioning everything and everyone. We were the world en miniature, with an experimental global village mentality. We were one, yet in every sense plural. We shared values and dreams, and we were endeavoring hard to reconcile our respective cultural authenticities with what we thought was modernity, to reconcile our respective political specificities with what we hoped was universality. Universality for us was surely not the American way of life or Western hegemony, but an elusive, yet to be defined, constellation of ideas and values enriched by the many inputs of every culture and every civilization. I'm sure that the quest for that universality still goes on today in this university and elsewhere too. Yes, we were one and plural. Proud nationalists, profoundly internationalists, totally cosmopolitan. With the student movement on the ascendancy, catalyzed by the Vietnamese tragedy, the 1967 war took place in the Middle East, resulting in the humiliating defeat of the Arab armies and in the Palestinian reawakening. Israel, in a continuing process of elastic expansion, dispossession and dispersion, occupied East Jerusalem then, the West Bank and Gaza, in addition to the Sinai and the Golan. A whole generation of Palestinian students were trapped abroad, and when Israel conducted a demographic census, we all became legally non-existent. This student community became the new wandering Palestinians. Many of us were already active in the resurrecting Palestinian national movement around Yasser Arafat and his colleagues. Now most of us joined in, becoming a major affluent within the PLO. Ladies and gentlemen, already in those days, many of our friends were Jews. They were anti-Zionists or non-Zionists. The West then was a cemetery for those in politics, in the media, or in academia, who dared question Israel's intentions or dared condemn its policies and practices. Reputations were ruined, careers were shattered, and character assassination was the name of the game. Israel felt immune to criticism, and the most unacceptable intellectual terrorism prevailed as a powerful deterrent. Philippe de Saint-Robert wrote that he received once a letter from one of his readers saying, Monsieur de Saint-Robert, you are an objective writer, but when Israel is concerned, impartiality is unwelcome. So some of the best critical books or articles were then mainly written by Jewish scholars, but even they would not escape insults and abuse. Self-hating Jews would be one of the mildest. The most radical among them questioned the very legitimacy of the Zionist enterprise in Palestine, while the more moderate believed that the creation of a Palestinian state was now a Jewish moral obligation, a Jewish ethical responsibility. I still remember with enormous political gratitude Rabbi Elmer Berger, Alfred Lilienthal, and of course Noam Chomsky in the USA. In Belgium, Marcel Liebman and Nathan Weinstock. In France, Anya Frankos, Ilan Halevi, and Maxime Rodinson at what was then the highly needed eye-opener in the intellectual circles, his Israel, a colonial settler state. In the UK, Elie Lobel, Moshe Machover, Yuri Davis, and Isaac Deutscher. Deutscher, in his criticism of the Prussians of the Middle East, offered a parable of his own to make comprehensible the human dimensions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Putting aside the calculations of politicians and the machinations of states, Deutscher said that this conflict was between a person who had to jump from a building on fire, but landed on another person whose back he broke. Each time the second person moaned of pain, or tried to stand up again, he would receive a beating for fear of revenge or claims for compensation. A prominent French Jewish intellectual visited Israel during those days and returned profoundly disturbed by the arrogance and the macho military mentality he encountered. I will never forget his remark then, "These Israelis are no more Jews." These Israelis are no more Jews, an interesting statement, maybe that would deserve one day some further elaboration. Ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, rightly or wrongly, we were then considered a generation of adorable or of exasperating dreamers. Rightly or wrongly, the generations who followed were perceived as more disciplined, more career-oriented. But there were a few exceptions. Among others, the Palestinian students of the West Bank and Gaza, who played a leading role during the first years of the Intifada. They were models of self-sacrifice to whom the entire nation should be eternally indebted. Some decades ago, Daniel Bell, followed by Raymond Aron, predicted the end of ideologies. Some years later, the end of history itself was announced, to which André Fontaine, in a beautifully worded article in Le Monde, responded by saying, "If it's true that we are witnessing the end of history, then we are surely living the beginning of boredom." The way you have decided, ladies and gentlemen, to celebrate the 100th anniversary, of your alma mater, the theme, globalism, that you have chosen for the centenary festival, proves that we are not, definitely not, witnessing the end of idealism. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Safir, both for your advice and for your very forward-looking retrospective. What we're going to do now is we're going to take a series of questions, if there are any. They'll be taken in a batch of three, and after we've taken the first batch of three, we'll see how we're doing for time and decide whether we'll take any more. Do I have any questions? I can see one. Are there any more? That's two, I believe. And we could do with one more, if anyone would like. Three. Lovely. So if I will go in the order there, there, and then there. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman. It was good to see both speakers speaking about what really could only be described as conflict. Mr. Raviv in his speech dwelling on the present troubles that exist in the Middle East, and Mr. Safir going on a trip down memory lane, which, as I recall, was a time of unbridled hostility and unbridled conflict. What I would like to ask both speakers is, you've dwelt on the dangers, you've dwelt on the conflict. What I would like to know is, what do you see, what do you think would be the cement, if you like, which would cause the present peace to work? I mean, you've dwelt on the dangers, you've dwelt on the violence. What will cause that peace to work, and which will cement, what will cement that peace in place? Thank you.
Okay, question number two. Thank you, number three. Okay, just to summarise the questions, what do you think will cement the peace process? Progress can only be achieved by compromise on the settlements question, and can we break down the barriers between the two? Your Excellency, would you care to go first, if that's okay? Thank you.
Thank you very much. The cement, there are plenty of common interests between Israel and the Palestinians. Faith and geography has us in very close proximity, with our interests converging and interwoven in the economic field, in the common environment which we share, and we would like to keep it clean. In modern progress, in building better societies, in improving the education, in exchanging ideas that can lead us into the future, and so on. But in order to achieve this, we must first create the base, and the base is peace. And peace can only rest on confidence and slowly mutual trust and eventually reconciliation. So it is a slow process. It is an evolutionary process. We should not be euphoric. We should not expect progress overnight. On the contrary, we know that we are traveling together on a very difficult and complex road. But we hope that in the Palestinian movement, in the Palestinian national movement, which Mr. Safia has described so eloquently, its origins, its building, that there are forces who understand where their interests lie, where their future lie, where the good of their children is, and together that we can cooperate and build this essential coexistence. On the settlement issue, we know it is a thorny issue, but we have committed ourselves, when we started to negotiate, not to build new settlements, not to spend public money on settlements, not to confiscate land for expanding existing settlements. And we have agreed that the settlement issue will be on the table when we get to the permanent status negotiations. We have positions, we have our ideas how to deal with this problem, but it is not a problem that belongs to the interim agreement stage. It is not a problem that is part of the Oslo agreements. It is part of the permanent status when we get there. And it is artificial to build it up now into a pretext or make it a major issue. It is not at the moment a major issue. The major issue is negotiations, how to build brick by brick progress and to continue from the first phase to the second phase and to the third phase. On separation, it was not our idea. Our idea was to have peace and coexistence without fences. When we embarked on Oslo, we foresaw a peace where there will be complete freedom of movement, where Palestinians will be able, if they so wish, to come and work in Israel without any hindrance. We talked about figures of 40,000, 50,000. The Palestinian delegation mentioned 100,000. We said we are prepared. We know that a third of the gross domestic product in Gaza stems from employment in Israel. Separation was not our idea. Separation, apparently, the whole idea that is now propagated, it is not worked out, it is not a final decision, it is not a policy yet. But the cry for separation is a result of terror, a result of the feeling that it is impossible to have tens of thousands of Palestinians on our main streets when terror is so widespread. Take away the terror and the cry of separation will go away, and the cry for fences will go away, and we can go back to the ideal coexistence which we have originally envisaged.
Thank you, Ambassador. Mr. Safir.
Mr. Chairman, I have decided not to speak in my initial remarks about the current peace process for a variety of reasons. One, because I didn't want to ruin the ambiance of your festivities on its first day. Number two, because... No, I'm serious. Number two... number two, sir, because it so happens that a few days ago I got some very bad news. I had demanded for family reunification to get the right to live back again in my house with my family in East Jerusalem. And 5 days ago, I got niet for an answer. And my initial remark was to say, it seems that in certain Israeli leading circles, a peace process is the continuation of war, but by other means. So I wanted, unsure that I could restrain my anger, to speak of something else, make a sort of trip back into the past, rather than speak of the gloomy picture today. Today, the picture is extremely gloomy. I invite you to read Nabil Shaath, our eternal optimist, and see today how pessimistic he is in the columns of The Independent. I personally believe that the peace process is in intensive care, and really the meeting between Rabin and Arafat on Thursday is going to be a very decisive meeting that will decide whether we are still going through a smooth process or we are going to have to rethink the entire exercise. Now, I and the ambassador warned you, we don't see eye to eye on all issues. I personally believe that Palestinian violence was not the major factor to ruin the atmosphere of the peace process. When we sat at the negotiating table after the Oslo-Washington signature, we discovered that what was supposed to be withdrawal from Gaza was only redeployment. And because of the existence of the 20 settlements and the 3,000 illegal settlers, Israel kept 35% of this narrow strip of land overpopulated and overcrowded. Then we discovered that Mr. Rabin was totally unexcited and unenthusiastic about redeployment in the West Bank, and that there were two schools of thought in Israel concerning this issue. One school of thought said, since certain settlements are problematic to redeployment, we evacuate the settlements. Another school of thought, which prevailed, said, since some settlements are problematic to redeployment, we postpone redeployment. And we had a feeling, Mr. Ambassador, and I'm not being here rhetorical, that for months, long months, endless months, we in the Palestinian side were interested in the peace, while on the Israeli side, we were more interested in the process. The process being normalization with the Arabs, trips to Morocco and Oman, etc., while talking about fencing, caging in the Palestinians. You raised, sir, the issue of the fence. It will be a disaster if tomorrow we have this fence. It will aggravate the apartheid situation we have. Besides that, the Israelis are thinking of building the fence, eating up some 15% of the West Bank, all along the borders of 67, around East Jerusalem, and those 15% happen also to contain the aquifers of water, which en passant would also would have been evaporating. So unfortunately, we are in trouble. Now let me, and I wanted to avoid having to speak of that. Mr. Ambassador, we have debated 5-6 times already, always with great pleasure and great decency on both sides. And you must remember that I once said that if deterioration on the ground, and deterioration there is, because let me tell you that since the Oslo signature, there are 10% more settlers in the West Bank, that peace process is accompanied by accelerated settlement building. I remember having frequently said, boringly so, if the deterioration on the ground continues, Hamas is not going to become the majority tendency. It will become the moderate wing of Palestinian politics. And Mr. Ambassador, today you have Jihad Islami. And I remember, ladies and gentlemen, having said, and I take no pleasure in saying it, and I'm not preaching, I'm predicting, I used to say to my Israeli interlocutors, we, the Palestinian side, we are trying to play with you a winner-winner equation, the two-state solution. We have been unreasonably reasonable in accepting a transitional period, but we are offering you a winner-winner possibility. We still believe, Mr. Ambassador, and I say it with great pain, not demagogically, you still want to play with us a winner-loser equation, the zero-sum game, for those who know about the theory of games and decision. Well, a minority is going to emerge within our society, and minorities make history, not majorities, who will say, since I am condemned to be the eternal loser of history, I don't like it. To hell with the temple, down with the pillars, let's play the loser-loser equation, since I'm the loser already. Why should I allow the other side to be the winner? Sir, you mentioned compromise. I don't know why you restricted it only to settlements. We offer a historical compromise. We offer a historical compromise revolving around the notion of the two-state solution. And again, I say we are unreasonably reasonable. We accept that they keep 78%, and we will content ourselves historically up to eternity with only 22%. So it's not only compromise on settlements, it's compromise on everything. And it's not only the West Bank which is a disputed territory. This is a misreading by the Israeli side. It's the entire mandatory Palestine that is still today a disputed territory. And we see a two-state solution along the line of the 67 borders as the historical compromise. We don't accept the definition that says only the West Bank is disputed territory, and they generously offer to meet us halfway in between Jerusalem and Jericho. No, sir, it won't work. The loser-loser approach and equation will become the most likable, the most likely, for some likable, option and scenario. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we, the Palestinian society, are now passing through a profound period of debate. And I wish, Mr. Ambassador, that you would be aware that the anger and exasperation is greater within the pragmatic tendency and not within the extremist tendencies. Their position is simple. They just tell us, we told you so. If they are generous, they call us naive. If they are wicked, they call us traitors. We are neither. We are neither. And Mr. Ambassador, and I will end on this point, please, Mr. Ambassador, do not confuse our realism for resignation. Realism is noble, and I'm proud to say I'm a realist. Resignation is contemptible, and I have contempt for resignation, and do not misunderstand and confuse our realism to be resignation. Thank you.
Thank you. I think there was something there for us all to think about. I'd now like to introduce the pro-director, Professor Leifa, to speak on behalf of the school.
Thank you very much. I understand that this global festival has a culinary dimension to it, and therefore I'm not going to speak for very long. I don't want to keep you from the delights of that. But I would like to say that we're very conscious of the fact that this was an event conceived and organized by students, and both the director, myself, and by the way, the director's been present throughout these proceedings, appreciate your willingness to involve us in this event. Secondly, can I thank Mr. Aviv and Mr. Safir for their presence here and also for the frankness of their views. I think that we've learnt a lot from listening to them this evening. Third, can I thank our students? We like to think that this event could only have happened at the LSE. Both the director and myself are proud that the students had the foresight to organise this event and wish them well during the coming week. Finally, let me end with this thought. This old theatre has been the venue for some quite remarkable events. Last week, we were gratified to welcome here Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and he spoke to us about the political miracle that has taken place in South Africa. I think we would like to think that this inaugural event of the Global Festival will actually contribute towards the momentum for a lasting peace in the Middle East. Thank you very much, General Secretary.
I believe as the director managed to make it here, he'd like to say something for a minute. Dr. John Ashworth.
Thank you very much, Martin. I should explain that I had another engagement outside the school and I feared I wouldn't be able to be back at a time which was helpful to the programme, which is why the pro-director spoke on my behalf. But I would like, since I did manage to make it, just to add my words of thanks to his, to Vinnie and all those others who have helped organise this programme. I mean, congratulations to you all, and can I say how much I look forward to the rest of it. It seems to me, a wonderful idea to celebrate the diversity of human societies and cultures in this way. And I congratulate you on having had the idea, and all of us look forward to the week ahead. It is, I think, and the pro-director said it for me, a splendid LSE event, with a wide diversity of events, some serious, like this evening's, and what could be more serious. Some, well, I know Desmond Tutu wasn't here really part of the Global Village, but he almost was. We just got the timing a little wrong. But some enormously emotional and heartwarming, as those who were privileged to hear him will always remember it. He had a cynical audience of LSE persons in tears and on their feet. And again, a typical, we like to think, event of the school. And some events much less serious, as described in today's Beaver. I'm delighted to see that you're going to have some fun, as well as everything else. And finally, can I add my words of thanks to those of our guests who have helped to get the proceedings off to such a fascinating, absorbing, interesting, and wonderful start. Thank you very much.
And now to give the closing speech on behalf of the Students' Union, Gary Delaney, the Entertainments and Societies Officer.
I was going to say thank you for not laughing, but I won't do that now, okay? All right. First of all, I'd like to thank our distinguished guests here, His Excellency Moshe Raviv and Mr. Afif Safia, for their presence here and the hope it gives to all of us. Please participate and enjoy the rest of the festival. It's going to be good. There's free music, there's dancing, there's cultural shows, there's debates, and it's on for the next 5 days. The Indonesian show is on in here later tonight, so please turn up for that. And before I go, I'd like to thank all of those who've worked so hard to help us put this festival on. There's the Global Village Committee, the stewards, the porters, the school staff, the union staff, and many others. Thank you. I hope you join in the festivities, and will join in with me now to give some applause to our speakers today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If I could now ask you all please to remain seated until you're asked to leave by the stewards and allow the stage party to depart first. Thank you very much. Thank you.